Welcome to May with Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Can you believe it's already May? We have such fun things coming up in the next few months for May and June. And as you know, summer's just around the corner. We're going to have some fun with fiction over the summer. So I'd love to know, what are some of your favorite historic fiction reads? We'll also be starting our tea and talk meetups, where we'll have a chance to get together with a few people, have some tea, do some chatting about history. Our first two are going to be planned for Washington, D.C., Virginia area, and we're trying to put one together also in New York City. So if you're interested, please let me know. And now, sit back, enjoy our wonderful guests on Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Welcome, everyone. I am delighted to be here with Amy Fleming, who is, she has a book coming out soon. It is available for pre-order on Amazon. I'm going to learn all about it. But first of all, thank you, Amy, for joining us on the podcast to talk about your new project today.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a book about Margaret Moore Roper. And I'm so excited because she is someone, I feel like she's part of the way we tell other people's story, but I'm so excited to have you tell her story because I don't think it gets told just on its own.
It doesn't. You're right. She's always present. She's always in the room, but she's never actually mentioned. She's kind of in a background all the time.
Right. And it's that big family. And we may have seen that big, wonderful family portrait of Thomas More and his family. Yep. So she's there, but the spotlight's not on her. So I'm so excited. So let me ask you, what made you interested in sort of history in general? And in particular, what made you focus on Margaret, this person who's present, but not usually the subject of the focus? Tell us about that.
I've got a couple of people to thank for my interest, really. Is number one is sort of my parents, my mum, but particularly my dad. My dad was an older parent, and because my mum and dad were separated, I spent weekends with him, and he used to take me to various different places, and some names that you might recall, to places like Hardwick Hall and Haddon Hall, and because I'm from the Midlands originally, and he used to spend hours sort of wandering around these places. And when you're small, you don't really appreciate what they are, but I was always fascinated by who lived there and what they did and why they were there and what this is. And he'd always answer my questions, so consequently I was sort of interested from then. And then later on down the line, I moved around a lot, and I had a lot of very, very good history teachers, and the influence they had was phenomenal. I can't stress how much, especially when I got to A level and we started on early modern and Tudors. And my A level teacher, when I was 17, 18, she was fascinated with Henry VII. And I think that's what started me down that road. She was the real influence. And then I went to university, did early modern, and then I went back as a mature student and did early modern even more so. So it's just all been like this thread all the way through. So that's always been Tudors.
I think that's wonderful. And I love it when people are calling out parents and teachers, because I think we all, and I speak for myself as well as others, I think we all owe a big debt to parents and teachers who sort of steer us and invite us and provide us with these opportunities. So thank you. Now, Margaret herself, though, there are a lot of tutors who sort of grab the spotlight. So how did you get drawn to her in particular?
When I was doing my undergraduate, which was 2002, 2003, 2004, that sort of time, I did my dissertation on the Renaissance and the impact on the education of women. And when you start down that road, you naturally come across Mary Tudor, Catherine Parr, and then you end up with Margaret Moore. And it always ends up with the Moore sisters and the Cook sisters and the Grey sisters. And there's lots written about these women, but in sort of a very generalized way. And every time I read something about, I wanted to know more. And every time I found something, I put it away. And I thought, oh, I'll read that later. And then I thought, well, do you know what? Now's the time. I'm going to do it. And it turned out that she was absolutely fascinating as an individual. You know, we all know that, yeah, she was Thomas More's daughter. She was well educated. She was part of the Tudor realm. But when you actually get into what she did and how she did it, she's marvelous. The only word I can use to describe her.
Oh, well, that's great. And I know that she is sort of held up, she and her sisters held up among other women as this example of an unusual focus on educating daughters as well as sons. And that is one thing that it appears that her father, Thomas More, was really interested in and really committed to, was bringing the education of his daughters. I don't know that he was advocating for all women, but certainly he was determined to educate his daughters. Why do you think that was? What is it about the More household and Thomas More? And of course, he played a pretty big role in the government of Henry VIII.
Yeah, you'd say that.
And was very influential on Henry VIII, yeah, who also educated his daughters. So what was that all about?
I think there's two threads that we can pull at. You've got the sort of humanist influence on him. So he was wanting to bring out more of the, if you understand your religion, if you understand who God is and what the relationship he has with people, then you can be more pious, you can be more faithful, you can live your life in the truest Christian fashion. And that was basically what he wanted to do with his life and what he wanted his family to do with their lives. As a young man, he was torn between having a family and becoming a monk. So he always had this sort of, I want to be the truest form of Christianity that I can be. But in doing that, you had to, in order to understand, you had to be educated. So he wanted people, all people, including women, to have this knowledge of the original scriptures, the languages, the wider world in general. Being wise was what he wanted. And because of that, he wanted his own family to have this opportunity. But I also think that there's no getting away from the fact that Thomas More was a very intelligent person. He was inquisitive. He was well-traveled. He wanted to know more constantly about every subject under the sun. And I think it was quite a foreign concept to him that other people wouldn't want to do that. He wanted to know about astronomy, anatomy, mathematics, and all these things were not necessarily something that a gentleman, because he wasn't noble, he was just a gentleman. He wouldn't have done that he wouldn't have once needed that in order to be successful, but he did it anyway, regardless. He wanted to know. And therefore, he wanted everybody else around him to want that too. And I think that was the two things that he brought to this. Henry VIII, in some ways, was a similar sort of a character. He wanted to know. He wanted to learn. He had massive collections of books, and they had a lot in common. And there's lots of discussions in texts of how they would spend hours in discussing scripture segments, astronomy. There's famous quotes about them looking up at the stars on the palace roof and all this kind of thing. And I think that was the join that you can see between them. That's what was the crux of their friendship. But yeah, they'd known each other for so long that you can only imagine that they had lots to talk about. So.
Yes, and it's really interesting because, of course, Thomas More wrote quite a bit when Henry VIII came to the throne. It was very celebratory and full of praise, also full of praise. He certainly saw the greatness in Catherine of Aragon and her commitment. And so for a long time before their fallout, and they do have a pretty dramatic fallout, but for a long time before that, they really do share a great deal. And in fact, it is thought that Thomas More helped quite a bit, perhaps, when Henry VIII wrote his treatise, sort of against Martin Luther, defending the Pope, defending the Catholic Church at that time, the defense of the seven sacraments, that earns Henry VIII the title Defender of the Faith, that Thomas More was likely quite involved in that. And certainly the two of them shared that commitment and that interest in religion.
Yes. Yeah, both of them were able to sort of see the broader spectrum. They weren't just looking at it from a pure scripture sort of way, and they could look at it in a philosophical kind of a way. They both spoke Latin, Greek. They both enjoyed reading classics. They would have had massive conversations. There's a famous event where Henry VIII invited the entire More family to court to discuss it's the Quintilian problem, which, if you understand, it's a really old classical problem of what to do in a certain situation. And all of the girls gave their solution to this problem in front of the king, and the king was impressed, and he could see what was, and he gave his solution, and they discussed it. And it's not something that you probably would have seen, these three girls lining up in front of the king discussing classics. It's not something that you probably would have seen it, but Thomas More and his family and the king, that it was pure intellectual friendship in some ways. And I think that was an important thing for them both, that they almost the structure and the noble or gentleman position kind of faded away, and it just became about them learning from one another and challenging one another, which is probably why they fell out, because anytime you challenge someone, that's probably what will happen.
That's always a danger. But it does give us, I think, a positive view of Henry VIII that we don't always get, that he would sit with Thomas More and these very educated young women, because they were young at the time.
Yes.
And that he would value what they were saying and listen to what they were saying. And it does, I think, give us a favorable view of some of the things about Henry VIII. We know he changes, but there are moments where he is seeking information and knowledge and appreciating the voices of others and appreciating the value of women's education. It's not necessarily for everyone, but for them. Yeah.
Giving you an insight into that. Both of them, I think, prized that family relationship, and having, when this event happened, Henry had Princess Mary, and he also just had Henry Fitzroy, just about to start his education. So he was looking to see, this is what's possible. And his friend was sort of saying, this is what's possible. And it's egging each other on almost, it's an interesting dynamic between the two of them.
Well, and it's wonderful, because that's, again, a fatherly side of Henry VIII, wanting to have his daughter and his son learn and express ideas and do all of that. It's just this really exciting moment, and that's great. So Margaret was certainly grew up in that dynamic intellectual household, knew about the king, had met the king, had been with the king. So when she gets married, so she knows of the Tudor court, she knows about the king, and then into this very tight family of Thomas More, she brings in her husband, Will Roper. So what's that like?
She doesn't actually bring him in.
Okay.
He comes in as a almost an apprentice kind of role. His family and Thomas More's family go way back. They're both Lincoln's Inn trained lawyer families. That was the career that William was supposed to go in, and he came to stay with the Moors to learn under Thomas. I believe he was 15, 16 when he arrived, so Margaret would have been about 9, 10
right.
at the time. And he would have learned alongside the Moore school. He would have learned under Thomas. He would have gone to Lincoln's Inn and had his lectures and dealt with cases. But he stayed with the family a very long time. And the thing about the Moore family was that they were a very tight community. They ate meals together. And if you were in that household, you were at that meal. You said those prayers. You had that discussion. You became part of the family. And even if you were only there for a week, you were expected to partake in everything that the family did. You came to prayers. You did everything. So William would have become part of that family. And when Margaret turned 15, 16, her elder sister, her stepsister, Alice, who was Alice Moore's daughter, she'd married at 16. So it was kind of an expectation that Margaret would have done the same thing. And at the time, Thomas was an MP. He was doing okay. Mm-hmm. Wasn't particularly successful in inverted commas, you know, I mean, he was doing okay. But the marriage between the Ropers and the Moores at the time was very equal. It was beneficial to both. Everybody was going to gain something from it. And consequently, you know, William knew the family well. He was respected in the family. He was, you know, very well capable of keeping up with the rest of the family, which I should have imagined was very important. And he came into the family and was accepted as a prospect for Margaret to marry. And then when they did marry, when she was 16, he was 19, 20, that was just, they carried on. They didn't move out of the house. That's not what happened. You would stay in that family environment. So to some extent, I think it was just status quo. It was just expected, and they carried on, and they just did what the Moores did. And it just so happened that these two young people had gotten married. It was a thing within the Moore family that these young gentlemen that came into the house seemed to marry the daughters. One of the tutors that came in, John Clement, he married Margaret Giggs, who was one of the wards that was virtually the same age as Margaret. Other wards came in and were married off to other siblings. So it just became this exaggerated, massive community household with lots of people in it. And there's a quote that I put in my book that about how at some point, you know, you had sort of 11 grandchildren and all these generations living in one house, because he just wanted the whole family to be present all the time.
Thank you. I appreciate you clarifying how it's the family sort of growing from within, because they're bringing people in, they get to know them, and then the family's growing from within, and that anyone staying there becomes part of these practices, the family practice of eating together and praying together and speaking and having these discussions. All of that just continues to grow. So it is a vibrant, intellectual, stimulating, growing household, yes, that we have with Thomas Moore and his career, his friendship with Henry VIII. His career sort of takes on more and more of a public face, which was a mixed blessing at the time. Yeah. Always dangerous. Henry wasn't incredibly dangerous early on, but anytime, the closer you are to the seat of power, the more risk that is involved.
Yeah.
So as things are going on, and I have to say, one, you mentioned your parents. One of my mom's favorite depictions of Thomas Moore is the older movie, A Man for All Seasons, yep, which is sort of a classic with Paul Scofield. And actually, Robert Shaw is an amazing Henry VIII. But in that movie, you see Margaret as a determined and very well-educated and very confident young woman supporting her father as her father falls out of favor. So let's talk just a little bit about Thomas Moore has this friendship with Henry VIII, a lot of respect from the king. The king really wants Thomas Moore's approval. And I think that's one of the problems they run into. It's so important for the king to have Thomas on side, but yeah, then the king makes decisions that Thomas cannot accept, and the king can't just let it go. He keeps pushing and pushing. So tell us a little bit about what that does to Thomas and to the family when the king begins to really ask for more than Thomas can give.
So the issue really arises when Thomas doesn't feel like his conscience will allow him to allow this divorce and remarriage to happen. It's just not something that morally he can allow. So he decides to say, well, I'm going to step back. this is the path, I can't follow it. And that'll be the end of it. I will stay quiet. I will not criticize. Just leave me in my house to read my books is essentially his, I'm retiring. This is the end of it. But I think, like you say, it's that double-edged sword of he's developed this friendship, this close bond with Thomas. And the king just wants his friend to agree with him. He wants to be able to say, well, you know, this is this learned man that I really respect, and he's going to take this forward. When he can't do that, Henry starts to put the pressure on and Thomas digs in deeper. It's two very strong-willed men who will not give in to one another, and they start acting almost like children. You know, it's that sort of, well, no, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, leave me alone. No, you leave me alone. You came after me, all this kind of thing. And it puts the family in a position that is untenable. The family are having to say, no, we are loyal to our father. We're loyal to this man who supports us, who houses us, who has taught us everything we know. But equally, people are being dragged off to the tower. People are being tortured. People are being executed for not following what the king has said. And when eventually it gets to a point of you have to take this oath or you will go to the tower, Thomas goes to the tower. Now the family, you know, there's children, there's lots and lots of people that are reliant on Alice, Margaret, William, the wider family. And they can't follow. So they have to take the oath. And what's funny is that Margaret, everybody else takes the oath. And Margaret is brought up to say, yes, I'll take the oath. But she actually changes it to make it more to sit better with her moral standing. And there was a group of Carthusian monks who had refused. And in order for them to just carry on with their lives, they had added, as far as will stand with the law of God, onto the end of the oath. And Margaret does the same thing. Really risky for anybody to do that, let alone somebody who is in a position of, you know, well, your father's in the tower and everything is going to be taken from you. But they kind of go, oh, well, she's only a woman. We'll let her husband deal with her. And she's allowed to do that and say, yes, I took the oath. And I can only imagine how she must have felt coming out of that meeting going, oh my God, it worked. But she, you know, this is the kind of thing that the family had to make this choice. And Margaret being so close to her father, both in terms of a relationship and also personality wise, I think she must have felt like, well, you know, really, I want to be in there with him. This is what I believe. This is what I want. But she couldn't do that. She'd got little children. She'd got her family to worry about. So this is the solution in her mind, and it works. The rest of the family they take it. They just go, okay, yes, 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 we'll do that, because all of their money's been taken away. Their houses are going to be taken away if they don't. So they are in a position that they can't. Margaret, as a married woman, is actually quite isolated from it. She's able to take her chance and try to show loyalty to the king, but also to her father.
It's an amazing thing, because it's as if all of that education and all of that intellectual stimulation and that great mind has allowed her to make her own way and to do it in a way that pleases the council enough, plays on the fact that she's, quote, only a woman, as yep. you say, legally, that getting married has reduced her legal authority or legal standing.
Yep.
So she does have a little more, but instead of regretting that, she uses that in her favor. I mean, has so much, as you were saying earlier, to be wise. I think this shows just extraordinary wisdom and an ability to really think strategically to align herself both with her father, but with survival. And, you know, taking that oath that the king required of everyone, and she knew he was executing people for not taking it. I mean, Tom, it was not, it's incredibly sad, but it wasn't a surprise that eventually her father would be executed. Henry was, you know, he was ruthless.
He was determined. He gave Thomas lots and lots of opportunity to sort of say, well, no, come on, you can just say it. No, you know, nobody will question it. You can just go home. It's fine.
Yes.
But like I say, they're just at loggerheads. They can't.
Yes.
One will, yeah, it's immovable object, unstoppable force situation.
Right. And you wonder, why couldn't the king just let him retire and go home? Or why couldn't Thomas just do it the way Margaret did, or do it the way the Carthusians did?
But yeah,
Thomas was determined and the king was determined, and they were just both dug in. So the rest of the family is navigating, and Margaret is navigating in her own way, which I just think is so admirable and so wonderful. All right. So the family does have to face Thomas deciding he's not going to budge in any way. He's not going to play it. He is determined.
Yes.
Now, when he is, sadly, I hope it's not a spoiler alert for anybody, when he is executed, which is a huge risk to the family.
Yes.
There is a story. There is a legend. I want you to address this, if you will, please. Because, you know, if you're executed as a traitor, your head's cut off, it's put on a spike, and it's on
Tower Bridge.
Yeah. So every time you're going up and down the Thames or whatever, and it's a way of discouraging any other, you know, it's also a way of just being grisly. But so there's this legend that the head disappears and that Margaret is the one who takes the head. Is that true? Can you talk to us about that and why that would be so important so that the legend would grow? Because it's pretty big legend, right?
It's huge. To start off with, I'll just level with you. We only have a couple of sources that are even close to being accurate on this. The main one being Thomas Stapleton, who wrote his Life of Thomas More sort of about 50 or 60 years after. She didn't steal it. She didn't sort of dress all in black and go climbing up the bridge. The sources sort of recount the tale of her bribing the official so that when the head was due to be, because they didn't do anything with them when they took them down. They just kind of threw them in the river and that was the end of it. So she, when it was due to be removed, she had bribed the official to take it down and give it to her instead of it being just left to its fate. Now, the source goes on, Stapleton goes on and says that she was brought before the council and she admitted that she had saved her father's head from being devoured by the fishes. That's as much as we know. The records from the King's Council don't exist anymore. They're gone. So we'll never know what happened at that meeting, whether or not it actually happened. The only other evidence we have is the fact that there is a head buried with her. And in St. Dunstan's Church, in the Roper Crypt, right next to where she and William are laid to rest. Now, it's said that she had the head coated in tar and preserved and kept with her until she died. And then when she died, she was buried with it. But that's basically all we know. And there's a gap. And there's no way that we will ever know whether or not that head in Canterbury is the head of Sir Thomas, but my personal feeling is, who else's head would it be? I've been to church in St. Dunstan. St. Dunstan in Canterbury. You can't go down into the crypt, and because it's a Church of England church, you can't go down and see it. You know, because they don't want people going and paying homage to it or anything like that. But they have had archaeological digs and things like that, and excavations and investigations, and it looks like the crypt was, it's all the same age, and the head's been there that whole time and everything like that. So it stands to reason to me that is Thomas's head, but there's no way we'll ever know.
Right. And I appreciate that. And, you know, And yet this legend came from somewhere. I know these legends aren't, you know, documented or whatever. And some of them are stranger than that. In the yes. world of legends, that one's not that strange, that the idea that you would want some part of this father that you loved to be buried with honor, and that you would want to get whatever part of his remains back that you could, and the rest wasn't available. So this is what
his body when he was executed was kept in the tower buildings and buried as other traitors' bodies were buried. So there was no way that she was able to do anything. Now, Margaret Giggs, Margaret Clement, mm-hmm. she was present at the execution. Margaret Moreau was not. She, for going, it's various reasons why she might not have been there, but Margaret Giggs was. And it's, according to the records, she was the one that was responsible for dealing with Thomas's body and making sure that it was dealt with dignity and things like that. But that was it. Nothing else could be done. So right. to have part of her father with her must have been very important to her, as it would be to all of us. You know, you can't yeah. just sort of say that's the end of it. But the fact that this has grown into a, she did something amazing and things like that. But once again, she was brought up in front of the council for doing this, for removing something which was not supposed to have been removed. And once again, they just went, ugh, she's just a woman. So once again, she kind of used this, this status sort of say, well, you know, why would I do a silly thing like that? I just saved my father's head. That's all I did. You know, that's all I'm going to do. And they again just sort of said, okay, we'll leave you be.
Mm-hmm. We'll let your husband. Yeah. Yeah.
So she every time she comes up against an issue or a problem or an authority, she's not daunted. She just says, this is what I'm doing. And you can, you know, but she just manages to skirt that line of, I'm not doing anything wrong. Like, even when she's doing things that, like stealing something that isn't supposed to be stolen, she manages to say, no, I'm okay, which is amazing.
It is amazing. And you can see why, knowing that personality, the legend sort of evolved into not bribing the person who took it down, but dressing all in black and climbing up on yeah. the tower and dragging it out the day it was supposed to be there, you know, in this big gap. Where did his head go? So you can see how the legend grows.
Yeah.
But the idea that she would take a risk and do what it took to honor her father in the way that she was able to. The body was not available, but if there was a way to get the head and give that head a burial, you can see that that might be something that would make sense for her to do.
I think she also appreciated that anything of her father's had value
yeah.
to herself, the humanist cause, the Catholic Church, to anything, because she spent the remainder of her life trying to collect anything that her father had written, made, touched, all came together under her. And everybody was, when she died, she was very careful to spread it back out again so that it didn't become this sort of problem for her family. Because as time went on, it became dangerous to be a Thomas More supporter, a Thomas More follower. And so she didn't want one member of her family holding on to this stock. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of it went to her children, part of it went to her brothers and sisters, part of it went to her friends, part of it was never seen again. So, you know, it's interesting that I think for her, his writings and his head and his letters all became part of his legacy for her as much as for anybody else.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it. So I want to just sort of look at that over a period of his death and why she didn't attend. You mentioned that, and then sort of going forward. So let's start with, you know, this terrible event. And she wasn't there, but someone from the family, of course, yeah. was there. But then her preserving his legacy so that so much of it was preserved. So tell us that story, because I think that's so wonderful.
But she wasn't able to attend Thomas wrote her a letter the day before, which managed to get to her. Now, transport being what it was, it's likely that that letter didn't even reach her until the day he was actually executed. So she might not have even known that it was due to happen that morning. He may well have instructed her, do not come, because it was dangerous to be there. Margaret Clement, John Clement was King Henry VIII's personal physician at the time. So she would have been, if not in the tower, she would have been very close by. She would have been able to get there quite quickly, whereas Margaret and the wider family were out Chelsea, which was a very long way. Even by today's standards, it takes a long time to get from where Chelsea Manor was to the Tower of London. The other thing that she might just not have been able to cope with seeing this happen. She had her young family. She didn't particularly want to be. She may well have said her goodbyes already, which, if you know the story of when he was, his trial, when he was sentenced, she forced her way past all the guards, not once, but twice, so that she could embrace him and kiss him and say goodbye to him. So it may well be that they sort of said that, well, that's it now. But she tried, I think, to, instead of think, well, you know, he's dead, she wanted to see how he could live on. And I think that became her focus, rather than saying, oh, I'm going to go and see my father executed. Nobody would have wanted to see that, I don't think. But she concentrates on gathering letters, books. She gathers in anything that may well have been his before they could come and take it away. Because traitors, he was put under attainder, and all of his belongings were taken in. His books became the ones that she didn't manage to take away, became part of the king's library and things like that. Things like that make me wonder just how much did Henry actually want his friend to be executed. It's like, don't make me do this. Please don't. You're going to make me do this. And then he comes in and takes all his nice books and all his nice things and says, oh, well, if I can't have you, I'm going to have all your things. So
right.
I think she tried to save him from being, his cause from being forgotten and him from being forgotten. And in his letters and his work, he remained a presence in her life. Yeah, she's amazing.
It is amazing. And it is what, as you said, it allowed him at a time when his name, I mean, he'd been executed as a traitor. His name is dangerous.
Yes.
But she maintains that legacy and allows him and his memory to remain something clean and wonderful and shining and, you know, a beacon in a way for the family and the friends. You think of that household he had, all those people he had gathered together in this large household. And rather than completely lose him, she manages to keep those parts of him, his legacy, his writings, some of his books, some of those tangible parts of him did survive during a time where it was dangerous. And so tell us, her life goes on and her children, what does her life look like with him gone? And you mentioned she starts distributing things again so that they won't all be left with one person.
When he was executed, like I say, the Chelsea Manor was no longer the Moore home. Alice had her own lands. She went off and lived quite a happy life, by all accounts, in her family lands. The children all had, Thomas had managed to sort of keep some things back for various different people. He'd signed bits of land over. He'd signed leases over, because despite the fact that he had this big house and he had all this stuff, he wasn't actually very monetarily rich. He didn't actually own very much. He mainly leased things or borrowed things or had things that, you know, oh, well, I'll just keep it for a while. So consequently, he signed over a lease for the house they had before Chelsea, the barge up in Cheapside. He signed that over to the Clements. And the Ropers managed to keep hold of a couple of bits and pieces, but well, the house Butts Close, which is like a little annex to Chelsea, that was no longer available to them. Now, thankfully, William's family had lands and homes that were available to them, so they had to then change and go to. They had a house in Eltham, which is Well Hall, which if there's a restaurant, I believe now in actually in one of the buildings, it looks very nice. And also the Place House, which is at Canterbury, which I, according to what I've seen and read, that was their main home. They made their home in Canterbury. It was close enough for William to come back because he was an MP and a lawyer, so he could come back and forth to London. But it was far enough away that they were able to separate themselves from the turmoil that was surrounding Henry's court at the time. It was a dangerous place generally. The atmosphere was all over the place, especially after Thomas's death, when you quickly go from the amazing marriage, birth of Elizabeth. In less than 3 years, you're back to square one and Anne's executed. And it's, I don't think anybody imagined that this would be what would happen. And the Moors tend to take themselves away from it. They keep themselves as safe as possible, for the most part. Anyway, there are occasions where they do once again come into problems because of they are maintaining their humanist links, and they're being accused of things and brought up in front of the King's Council again for having books that they weren't supposed to have and links to people and all sorts of things that you think, oh, just keep your head down, please, you know, just stop. They're associated with the Poles, because obviously they're a good Catholic family. So when Geoffrey Pole is brought in, Margaret Roper, Margaret Giggs, William Roper, they're all, their names are in his little black book of contacts. They're all brought in again. But again, because she was married, and because she had small children, she was able to say, oh, I'm very sorry, sir. It won't happen again, sir. And she was let off again. Now, some of her family members weren't so lucky. And there was lots of times where Margaret just saw, especially male members of her family, just gone. And it was every time she thought that things were changing for the better, somebody else was taken away from her. And you get the feeling as she gets older and as she spends more time with her children, educating them in another generation of the Moor school, that she becomes a little bit more pragmatic and sort of doesn't want to rock the boat as much, and tends to just keep a little bit more of a low profile. I don't think low profile is something that the Moore family generally enjoys, so it's hard for her, I think, but she tends to be quite quiet. She's got her children, while they are old, and you know, by the time she's sort of getting to 1540s, the children are older, but they are still learning, and they are, she's trying to balance being a mother and being a scholar and being a good Catholic and trying to fight the good fight from the humanist groups. And so it was such a time that she couldn't really risk too much. That's not to say she didn't take any risks, but she couldn't risk too much.
Right. Well, and that, you know, she doesn't want to take herself out of being able to keep up the good fight and be a good Catholic, because exactly. Henry is very unpredictable in his view of religious reform, and it keeps changing.
It does and change.
Those at court who get caught up in it when he changes his mind, like Cromwell, don't tend to live. So, you know, in order to keep fighting the good fight, you have to keep yourself alive. And that's part of the pragmatism that she exercises, as well as, and this is such a great example of that, wanting to maintain this wonderful collection of her father's material, but realizing if it all stays with one person, it is at so much risk
Yes.
Collection is at risk. The person is at risk. So to distribute it among different people is, you know, although there's a sense of greatness in having it together, but distributing it is the best chance it has. Yes. And the best chance the people have. Oh, I only have this one letter of not being caught up in anything.
Yes, this is of sentimental value. This is nothing. It's no problem. But famously, when after she died and everything had been distributed, of course, William Roper writes his life of Thomas More. And famously, he has to go round his relatives and say, oh, can I see this letter? Can I read this book? Can I have this back just for a week so I can read this so that he can write this book? Now, without Margaret's work, he wouldn't have been able to write that book, and we wouldn't know as much as we do about Thomas. It's Margaret's work. As anybody who spends any time in archives will know, it's the archivist that's the real genius. It's not the person that writes the manuscript that's the real genius. It's the person that collates everything and manages to put it all in context. And it fascinates me that she spent ostensibly a decade bringing this all together. Mm-hmm. But because she was having to do it in such secrecy, was her intention to write this book? Was her intention to put her father's life into the spotlight once again, once it was deemed safe, like William did? Was this her wish? And did he just carry out her wish? Had she actually started writing it? That always fascinates me, because there's a change. If you read the manuscript, it sort of changes a bit in the middle. And you read it and it's like, oh, you know, there's lots of references to my father-in-law did this and my father-in-law did that. And then it was in our house. And it's like, well, that's a very different style of writing. And it's like, you read it and you're like, whose voice is this? Is this William or is this Margaret coming through?
That's really interesting. And I hadn't really paid enough attention. I'm going to have to go back and reread it. I'm looking for that, because I was, you know, that's not always, that's very subtle. And I hadn't, you know, I was sort of awash in the details, but that's really interesting. Well, and I really do like what you said, that without her efforts to save all of this and collect it all, we would not have that life of Thomas More. No. That was her work and Will's, but maybe more her work than we think. But we wouldn't have it at all.
No. Everything that comes after, mm-hmm. The Stapletons, the Shakespeares, and even down to now, we're still looking at these texts. We're still looking at these letters. We're still looking at William Roper's words for who was Thomas More.
Right.
So Margaret's influence is coming right the way through. But up till recently, like I say, she's been present in the room, but we haven't seen her. And I think that now you can, as more people are starting to appreciate the fact that women have had this influence and individuals have had this influence, that you could see that it's not just one man telling another man's story.
Right.
It's a collaboration.
Oh, I love that idea, because it's easy to just say, oh, on the surface, it's one man telling another man's story. But no, it's actually this young woman who goes from being a young woman talking with the king, demonstrating her knowledge and understanding in a moment where things are good with the king, and really seeing that for what it is. Being there to see the change in the relationship. I mean, she had a front row seat for the whole thing her father went through and of those decisions that he had to make, because Henry was his friend, but he was going in the wrong direction, as More thought. And you know, to see how Thomas had to hold the line, but how she herself could continue his story by keeping herself alive and the different choices she made.
But she was also Thomas's mouthpiece at so many occasions. Even when she was a teenager, when she did her, she published her translation of Erasmus, she couldn't put her name on it, because this was unheard of. Women didn't publish, especially not in English. No, that's not what we do. But she was brave. Everybody who was part of the court circle could figure out from the text who she was and where this had come from. And she was proving her position was, you know, she was meant to be there. She was able to be there. She was not just some silly woman. She was educated. She was pious. She was dutiful. She was loyal. And then, so when she comes around and writes these letters with her father from the tower as his mouthpiece, she had this history of being his mouthpiece, of showing exactly what the humanist cause was and why these things were so important. There's lots of examples that I've given a few of them in the book of her being this proxy for all good humanist women and what they are truly capable of. There's bits of her of being the one that they could rely on, that they were, that she was the one that was held up, like you say, of, as being the example that everybody should follow. It's big shoes to fill for Margaret, and it must have been quite hard for her. But at the same time, I think she relished it. I get the feeling from the letters that we have and the bits that we see, she was up to the challenge. She was going for it, and she took it on. So.
Yes, and her success is now having sort of another moment in the spotlight, because now we are realizing that it's because of her that Thomas More has the status that he does and that is looked at the way he is, has the appreciation, and that this woman who may not have legally had the ability, but she herself had the ability to be the difference maker and to the archivist and the spokesperson who makes sure that these humanist and very devout, religious, loyal stories of his and of a woman's education and what a woman is capable of really come shining through.
We kind of see her influence as well, because in her daughter, Mary, she goes on to write lots more Catholic, because obviously at this point we're into Mary the First train, and she's part of Mary the First circle, and Mary the First was a very humanist educated woman, so the two must have been quite interesting to listen to the conversations between the two of them. But she was, well, again, just like her mother, she was a mouthpiece, and the parallels between Mary and Margaret and Mary and Catherine are quite staggering when you look at the relationships that they had and the time that they spent together or didn't, as the case may be. They were separated because Margaret died, Catherine was taken away. Mm. Various different things that happened in their lives. And you can only imagine that they must have had this sisterhood almost.
Yes.
But you see the influence of Margaret's ability to communicate her ideas and to use her knowledge in how Mary puts things across. Mary was so influential in Catholic literature during Mary the First's reign, and the learning that her mother gave her was what was able to make her so. So it's, you see this legacy going through almost immediately of how Margaret was the one that was, she's the common thread, I think is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
She's the one thing that links all of these events and all of this together.
And the generations from Henry to his daughter. And of course, there was Edward's reign in between there, which was very difficult for Catholics. So the fact that they were sort of hanging on and then in Mary's reign had an opportunity again to be at court, these legacies of Thomas and then Margaret and now in her daughter, to be at court again and part of those discussions again and carry that on. And that really is wonderful. Oh, Amy, this has been such a treat. I appreciate learning so much about this woman that I thought I knew, but now I really know. So tell us, I know your book's available for pre-order, but tell us what the schedule is. So when can we pre-order now, but when can we look forward to
it? Pre-order now. But the book is released on the 30th of July this year, okay. So 2024. Okay. And then I've got some bits and bobs popping up for talks and launches and all sorts of things. So
great.
Oh, it's very exciting.
Oh, so exciting. So exciting. Now, I will put all of this in the show notes, but where can we find you? Social media and stuff. Where can we keep track?
Yeah, I'm mostly active on Twitter and Instagram. The handle is HistoryAmy79, I believe.
Okay.
But I'm on there. And I also have a little blog, which again, if you go onto my Twitter, I've got the link on there. It's all on there. But yeah, I'm currently just sort of trying to, because I'm actually in the middle of another project as well. So it's about Henry VIII's childhood. So it's my life's sort of a bit all over the shop. I'm always going to flip from Margaret to Henry. So yeah, but I'm looking at that in more detail. So yeah.
Oh, good. So more to come. Well, I'll have all this in the show notes, but I do want to thank you for helping us see this woman who has been in the room, but really to just pull her into the center and give her a voice. And that is such a wonderful thing. So thank you. Thank you for being here.
No, thank you ever so much for giving me the opportunity. It's not something I've done much of before. So thank you for making it so easy.
Well, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you've enjoyed it. And thank you everyone for listening. I'll have all the information and we can wait excitedly for the release. But thank you for listening and joining us today. And we'll see you again soon. Thank you for joining us on Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I really appreciate your listening. Would also love it if you'd leave a rating, tell me what you thought, maybe share with a friend. Really helps. I also want to give a huge shout out to all of my wonderful patrons. If you've ever considered joining the patron family, this is a really great time. Thank you all for being part of this journey. As we look at all of the ways that history shows us what's possible. Thank you.